So we acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spotless, fluffy as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a
welcome to Yarns at Yinhu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 9, Find the Remote, October 8th, 2013. I'm your host, Sarah, podcasting from Silver Lake Tea House. Show notes for this episode are located on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. I hope you will consider liking the show's Facebook page or joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry. You can find me on Ravelry and Twitter as Sarah Pomegranate. I welcome your suggestions and comments. This week, I heard from Laura Brownlee, who left a note about color and photography on the website. She's also been trying to photograph some goldenrod, and she mentioned some of the same difficulties with getting the exact color yellow in the photograph that she sees in real life. I heard from Sherry of Spinner's End Farm and Paula of Knitting Pipeline, who sent a note of encouragement for my podcast and the website. Thanks, Paula. There was a new 5-star rating and a review from Vanessa One on iTunes. Sundance Funny Pants entered the Teacher Tribute Challenge, and I encourage you to enter as well. To enter the contest, think of a meaningful teacher in your life. It may be someone who taught you in a classroom or someone from whom you learned in a less formal environment. Write a letter to that teacher and mail it. Then post a tribute to that teacher on the Ravelry thread or leave a comment on my website under episode 7. You have until October 31st to post your tribute in a comment or a reply. In early November, I will select 2 prize winners, one drawn at random from the comments on episode 7 and one from the Ravelry thread. I'll tell you more about the prizes and post photos once I purchase them. I have some priority prize shopping to do at Rhinebeck this year. Ravelry members can also double dip by posting on the U University Forum. Rather than the traditional segments I have in my podcast, this week is all about 36 hours Samuel and I spent in Vermont over the weekend. At Yinhu, we don't have television, so we don't have a remote control. For us, finding the remote is all about getting away from the house and the worries of our lives for a little bit of time. And 36 hours in Vermont, let me tell you, is nowhere near enough time to enjoy all of the things that can be enjoyed around this time of year. Nevertheless, we did make the trip. It was in honor of my youngest sister, Jessie's birthday. At the end of the episode, I will have an interview that I recorded with Jessie about the pleasures of living in the Green Mountains of Vermont and about some of the post-apocalyptic skills that she has honed before and since she's moved there. Samuel and I left before noon on Friday and headed up to Vermont. We went over to visit Jessie's farmstead Friday evening and enjoyed a lovely candlelit dinner there. On Saturday, Samuel and I visited Plymouth Artisan Cheese. This cheese store is located next to the Calvin Coolidge Homestead in Plymouth, Vermont. It's a nice excursion for a couple of hours, and on the way we stopped several times to take photographs. I couldn't do any knitting in the car because I was too busy admiring all of the fall colors in the foliage. When we got there, we toured around the farm a little bit and saw some of the buildings associated with Calvin Coolidge and his presidency. And we walked next door to Plymouth Artisan Cheeses. Just outside the door and across the road is a small enclosure with a few sheep. And I was standing there watching them with my camera ready, and first one, and then two, and then three sheep lined up so I could take their photograph. I'll include the photograph in the episode blog. There was a woman standing behind me who said, I didn't even know she was standing there, and all of a sudden she said, how did you get all of those sheep to line up for their picture? Which I thought was really charming. We went inside and did a lot of tasting. Plymouth Artisan Cheese invites you to do as much tasting of the cheeses as you want, which we examined thoroughly before making our purchases. My favorite was a 2-year-aged cheese called Hunter. We bought quite a bit of that, and also a smoked cheese, which I hope to use a little bit later in the week in some recipes. On Saturday evening, we went to Ripton, which is a little north and west of where my sister is farming. There is a place there called the Ripton Community Coffee House. Once a month, they have a fundraising event with a performer that they bring in, or a group of performers. And this charming group we saw was Goldilocks and the Three Bears. They're from Quebec in Canada, and the group featured 3 fiddle players and a keyboard player. And we were told that usually it's 3 fiddle players and a guitar player, but they had a little bit of change in personnel that evening. They're young players, I think 17, 18, and 19 years old. They did a variety of pieces, reels, jigs, a classical piece, and some more contemporary things. And also a few pieces that were written or composed by the father of one of the members of the band. The Vermont Coffee Company donates coffee, and there are baked goods, and all of the money raised goes to a local charity. It was very well attended, even though Ripton is incredibly remote. If you happen to be in the area, I suggest that you look to see if there are any performers playing at the Ripton Community Coffee House, because you would really enjoy a visit to see what's going on. On the way home, we visited the Dorset Farmers Market, and it had rained very heavily just about an hour before we arrived. Some of the tables were like moats in an island of water, but still, everyone in Vermont had their tall rain boots on and people were still shopping. So we shopped around and made a few purchases of baked goods. I bought some local potatoes and also some rainbow chard. Last year we were there at about the same time in the season and I brought home rainbow chard. It was incredibly delicious. So I plan to make some recipes with that a little bit later in the week. I brought 3 projects with me and worked on only 2 of them. I worked on my string band hat for Samuel. It's coming along very nicely. Alternating the colors is making the work seem to go quickly, and all of the garter stitch makes it fly off the needles. And I also started a new project, 22 Little Clouds by Martina Bame. This is for the Knit Girls Bame Along project. I'll be talking a little bit more about it in episode 10. The color of yarn that I'm using is some gorgeous greens and purples and little pops of pink. I think this will work up to be more of a scarf than a shawl. It's not incredibly deep, but the piece gets quite long and it has a ruffled edge, which is a technique I've never done before. I think it will make a nice holiday gift for someone, and it's certainly been a lot of fun to knit that up. Most of our time in Vermont was spent visiting my sister and her partner on their homestead. They are in a fury of preparations there because this is the first winter they plan to winter over. They're in quite a high elevation, as you'll hear my sister talk about in the interview, and they can accumulate quite a bit of snow there. So they have been harvesting from their garden and thinking about how much firewood they will need to winter through and other kinds of provisions. They will leave the mountain periodically during the winter, but they would primarily like to stay there And since they've never done that before, they're doing a lot of strategizing and a lot of thinking. So we left them to their own devices a lot of the day on Saturday, and they were doing some harvesting and visited in the morning and the evening. Like I said in my Hunted and Handmade episode, a lot of the learning I've done and the skills I've acquired have come from my family. So I'm very proud and very pleased to bring you this interview with my younger sister, Jessica. Hi, Jesse. Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. That's actually the first happy birthday I've gotten today.
Well, it's early, so hopefully you'll get a couple more.
It's early and Jesse's still groggy, so that's probably the reason.
Well, I'm sitting here on your screened-in porch in lovely Vermont. Can you tell us a little bit about the region we're in Vermont, and what it's like to live here?
All right. Well, we are in the heart of the Green Mountains. We're at 2,000 feet elevation. And the closest city is Rutland, which is half an hour away. It is rugged up here. And the people are rugged. And there's not a lot of us. right now everyone's out chopping their firewood, probably getting ready for winter.
Yeah, we've heard a lot of chainsaws.
That's on everyone's mind.
Who lives here with you?
I live here with my partner, Jesse, and our two wildebeest, dogs, Thoreau and Tula. And, hopefully we'll be moving some chickens up soon.
Oh.
Because we are planning to build a chicken coop in the next couple weeks.
And what kinds of wildlife do you guys see around here?
Well, we see a lot of woodcocks. We see a lot of grouse. We see evidence of a lot of bears and a lot of moose.
But you don't usually see them.
We don't usually see them. They hear you before you know they're there. And they're pretty quick to leave. And that's a good thing. And lately, actually, we've been hearing a lot of coyote activity nearby, which is sort of a new development.
Not good news for chickens.
Not good news for chickens. No. Chickens are going to require an electric fence and serious house fortifications to keep the predators at bay. Because actually, just the other week, we had a bobcat sighting at the top of our field. So, further predator activity.
And you also keep bees. Do you consider bees livestock?
You know, I hadn't. I consider bees a mystery. They're far too confusing to consider livestock, I think. I read a quote once that bees are somewhere between insects and God. They're just...
Oh, that's... I like that.
They're really hard to wrap your head around. They have these inner workings that I don't think we really understand yet. So I think with the bees, I consider it an obligation to try to help them survive. And beyond that, they just do their own thing, and I don't really get it yet.
You're just kind of a wide-eyed observer.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah.
This podcast is called A Podcast About the Fiber Arts and Other Post-Apocalyptic Skills. On a scale of 1 to 10, how prepared are you for the apocalypse up here in the Green Mountains?
I'd say overall a 5.
Wow.
But it really hinges upon what the apocalypse brings. The scenario, I think. Because I don't feel ready, let's say, for zombies.
Okay.
I haven't manifested my inner catness yet. I feel like, you know, if I could get a bow and arrow, a crossbow, some sort of really great weapon, at my disposal, I feel like I'd be more prepared. But as far as food and self-sufficiency goes, I guess we're pretty well off.
Yes, you had quite a day of harvesting yesterday. Tell us a little bit about all the things that you managed to harvest.
Yesterday was a harvest frenzy sort of day, which usually happens in the fall, either before a really hard frost or before a heavy rain, because it was a mad rush to get all of the roots out of the ground so that they wouldn't split in the rain that's expected. So we went around pulling out our storage carrots, our full-size rutabaga, and a couple different kinds of turnips. We have some storage radishes, and we also pulled out our giant kohlrabi, which some of them weigh more than 10 pounds.
Oh, wow.
They're enormous. And I'm hoping when the time comes, I will know what to do with a 10-pound kohlrabi.
You don't know right at this moment?
Well, I've used them in the past in stir fries in place of broccoli. It basically tastes like broccoli stem. And when you cook it, it acts like a broccoli stem. But how many recipes can you think of that you would use broccoli stem? It's not a lot.
Maybe roasting it.
I have done the roasted.
Does it bring out the sugars?
It does.
Okay.
Some of us get tired of the roasted flavor of kohlrabi. And it can, if you don't roast it high enough, get soggy. But it's also good in soup. I did try it in soup.
Okay.
And it's good. We have a bumper crop of giant kohlrabi, so...
What's a bumper crop?
I'd say a bumper crop to me is more than I was expecting, or just a really good year for something. You've got probably excess of what you need. And in that way, we probably have a bumper crop of carrots as well this year. And they were enormous carrots that I was pulling out of the ground.
Yeah, I will try to include a photo. If I can't get it on right away, I will include a photo in a later episode because...
Yeah, the photo really says it all.
Listeners need to see this photo.
And we have been trying to document more of our harvests and in photos and in writing because we forget year to year what we got and how much is enough and what a good sized carrot would look like. You sort of forget. I think it's good to take photos and write down and weigh things and compare.
So to be more subjective about your harvest and your proceedings and when you planted and where.
Yes, I think that's really important. Especially, I'm still adjusting to this new climate. I'm used to gardening in New Jersey. That's how I grew up, gardening with, you know, mom and dad. And they were, we had our ways and they were the ways that worked. And we knew what was what, but... When you move to a place where the temperature's different, the soil's different, the weather is different, it takes a while to get used to it, and I think documenting when you're starting out, I planted on this date and it was ready on this day, or you know, we got a lot of rain and it turns out this crop doesn't really grow well when it rains. That's been really helpful.
And so all of that planning is something you spend your winter... doing. So pretty much as soon as you finish all of your harvesting, you're going to be planning and ordering.
Yes.
For the next season.
Definitely. As soon as harvests are over and, you know, you've got your garden cleaned up, we start poring over the catalogs, the seed catalogs, right away. It's kind of embarrassing, actually, the amount of time I've spent reading seed catalogs, and you've got all your different varieties, too.
So is it like with clothes and shoes when you're online shopping that the writing makes them very appealing?
Yes, well, I've noticed with the different catalogs, there's a different catalog to appeal to different shoppers. Some of us are very visual.
Oh, so like a different demographic.
Yes. The Seed Savers catalog, for instance, has these beautiful photos. And if you're hungry, you will buy almost every seed variety that's featured with a beautiful photo. But the Fedco catalog, I think, reaches out to all of the writers and the readers because they get these very vivid descriptions of the flavors and, you know, what the plants look like. And no photos of the actual plants in the entire catalog.
So you have to use your imagination.
You do. And I end up ordering mostly from that. For whatever reason.
Okay, so we've pinned you down. So, you've talked a little bit about the gardening and the harvesting. What are some other skill sets that you've developed since leaving mom and dad and working on your post-apocalyptic skill set in another region?
I think a huge learning experience for me was dealing with firewood. And tree maintenance, which I really knew nothing about. I didn't know anything about cutting down trees for wood or how to identify which trees would be the best to burn, or which trees, you know, you could tell are going to die soon, and so they would be, you know, the best to harvest. And my partner has been instrumental in that because he knew so much, and he is trying to teach me.
And he's been a resident of this area his whole life.
Yes, and he grew up with the firewood harvesting just being a normal part of every year. And I think, you know, all the locals in the area, too, everyone up here knows how to swing an axe, knows how to stack and measure a cord of firewood, knows how to tell, you know, how long and how hot something will burn.
There's a lovely breeze, which you may be able to hear on the recording a little bit. And it's a overcast day, but it's not raining yet. It's a little drizzle. What do you think is of the highest value that you bring here?
I think probably more than the skills is the mentality. I hear in my head all the time, Dad saying, use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without. Yeah, I think the mentality of just making it work, taking what you have, using it, you know, whether that's the lumber that you salvaged from the side of the road or the windows and putting them into a new building, or if it's you have a bumper crop of carrots and you're getting a little sick of carrots, but you still find some new way to use them. Mom was great like that in the kitchen. She could always cook a meal. It wouldn't seem like you had the ingredients to make a fabulous meal, but she could pump one out. And I think, I hope I inherited that mentality and the abilities that come with that mentality.
What are you looking forward to in terms of fall cooking?
In terms of fall cooking, in Vermont,
that's Thoreau.
That's one of the wildebeests. I'm looking forward to, as strange as it sounds, cooking with tomatoes right now, because early fall is actually prime time for the best tasting tomatoes up here. And I just harvested the rest of my tomatoes from my greenhouse. In preparation for what will probably be a freeze coming soon. And I'm waiting for them to ripen on a blanket. But I'm looking forward to cooking with carrots. I have to say that because I have over 100 pounds of carrots. And we just dug our potatoes. And all summer I've been trying not to rob the potatoes. So I'm looking forward to cooking. Finally, getting to cook with the potatoes, and I don't have to feel like I'm stealing from the plant and ruining my harvest down the line anymore.
What are some of the seasonings you like to use with your fall harvest?
A little later in the season, when my fresh herbs are gone, I tend to lean towards a lot of Indian spices. I tend to spice things pretty heavily. But right now, while I can still get to my herbs in the garden, I'm leaning on thyme and marjoram pretty heavily and sort of adding them into everything I can think of, soups, and lately I've been making au gratin. I make this tomato-potato au gratin, actually, ooh, which is perfect for this time of year, and only this time of year, because pretty soon, you know, the tomatoes will be gone. And I've been heavily seasoning that with thyme, actually, which we have in excess of. And we're drinking thyme tea right now.
It's delicious.
Well. It really is probably delicious. The most commonly used herb around here.
One of my listeners has inquired about skills like making your own yogurt, making your own cheese, making your own butter. Mm-hmm. And I know you have some experience doing that. I've also done it, but I've only done it under your guidance and mom's. And yes. I'll just remind listeners, this is my little sister. She's taught me quite a bit. And at mom's house, we think, is Graham's butter churn.
Yes.
So tell us a little about it and your practice of making some butter.
The butter churn, that I hope is at mom's house, is beautiful. It's probably, I'm going to say it holds about a 2-gallon glass jar with a wooden paddle, and, you know, a crank handle on top. And you can make butter pretty quickly in this method using just heavy cream. You don't need any other ingredients.
And you said heavy cream, even if it's pasteurized, but not ultra-pasteurized.
Even if it's pasteurized. I've never tried ultra-pasteurized. I'm assuming that it would be fairly difficult to get ultra-pasteurized cream to finally separate. Mm-hmm. Because they've done quite a job of making it evenly blended. But the pasteurized cream is fine. And, it doesn't take that long to make it in the butter churn, but as most of us don't have butter churns at home, you can make it in a KitchenAid mixer or in a large bowl with an electric mixer that you would make, you know, cake batter or something with. Hmm. And for those who don't even have that, you can make it, if you're ambitious, in a mason jar. The mason jar method takes the longest amount of time. And the most arm strength.
And you basically screw on the lid and shake, shake, shake.
You shake, shake, shake. And, you know, there's a certain process that the cream goes through. There's these different stages.
Like what?
Well, regardless of what you're making it, what your vessel
what
is.
Method, that, okay.
What method. Go through the same stages. And the first stage is, of course, whipped cream. Most people have made whipped cream or seen it made, and you just, you know, you whip it up at medium speed at first, so you don't slosh it everywhere, and then go a little faster. You end up with whipped cream, you take some out, you put it in your coffee, you keep going. What happens next is your mother yells at you and says, don't go further, you're going to make butter, which is true.
But in the middle you have a clotted cream
yes.
product.
In the middle, you have this strange, clumpy product that doesn't look like it's good for anything. It looks like you've totally spoiled whatever you're doing. You're thinking, this is sort of gross looking. What am I going to do with this? You keep going.
You push, or you can take it out and put it on your Sally Lunn bun.
You could. You could smear that on something. And it's actually, it could be used in place of cream cheese.
Oh, or maybe you could use it in baking.
You probably could use it in baking.
Okay, but you forge ahead.
You forge ahead. And at this point, if you're using a KitchenAid or a bowl with, like, a hand mixer, you're going to want a dish towel just to drape around your bowl, or make sure that you're not, if you can't figure out how to maneuver that, you could just make sure you're not near anything that you will slosh on, because when the butter finally separates from the buttermilk, it's pretty fast. And if you're still mixing at high or medium speed, the buttermilk that's left over will slosh pretty much everywhere, which was my first experience with making butter in the KitchenAid.
Wearing it.
I wore it, yes. what you're, you know, the mixer will start to sort of labor a little bit, or You'll notice if you're shaking it in a ball jar, you can actually hear a thud, you know, in your jar. So something is rattling around, and the butter will separate completely from the buttermilk. And you don't have to worry about going too far, because you will know. You will know when to stop. You will definitely know. and your buttermilk will be fairly clear. It's cloudy, but it's light. There won't be much.
It won't look like buttermilk you buy in the store.
It will not look like buttermilk. That's actually a different... Buttermilk you buy in the store is not made the same way the original buttermilk was made, which was, of course, the milk left from making butter. Buttermilk now is made with a culture, a lot like yogurt, which is what makes it so thick.
Even though it's made with 1% milk, yeah, or 1.5% usually,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. So the original buttermilk is very thin, and you can use it. It's great in recipes. It's great in bread, in place of water. It makes very soft sandwich bread. But yes, so anyway, back to the butter. You end up with this lump of butter in your buttermilk, and you want to strain the butter through. You could use a cheesecloth, or you could probably even use a colander or something, maybe a mesh colander of some sort. And you save your buttermilk, you put it aside. And then you want to run your butter under cold water and work it together. So you sort of knead it with your hands under cold water. And the cold water is necessary because if you have warm hands and you're kneading this butter, it'll just become a sticky, slimy, greasy mess.
Because you'll be melting the butter.
You're melting the butter in your hand. So cold water. Okay. And you're kneading the butter to get the remaining buttermilk out. That sort of gets trapped in little, you know, air bubbles inside of this fat. And you want to just knead the butter under running water until the water runs clear and there's no more buttermilk left. And at that point, it's unsalted butter. But if you wanted to have salted butter, you could just quickly, you know, you'd sprinkle your sort of ball of butter that you have made with your hands with some salt, and you would just work it in a little bit with your hands, and you'd have salted butter.
Salted butter.
You could do it with a spoon in a bowl if you're ambitious, but honestly, it's easier to do it with your hands.
I remember reading Little House on the Prairie books, and for a special occasion, Ma colored the butter by grating carrot and pressing it through a piece of cloth.
To get the juice.
To get the juice. And it turned the butter a bright yellow. I think the purpose of that was because they had had a hard winter and their milk was not necessarily coming out a creamy yellow color when they made the butter.
Right.
When you've made butter, is it yellow?
It is yellow. And it's yellow because I've made butter mostly in the spring, and I've made it with local cream from what was most likely Jersey cows, who have a much higher fat content in their milk. And these are grass-fed cows, so they have a really good diet. And so the butter, yeah, the fat...
It
comes up yellow, and that's, I think they originally started dyeing cheese for the same reason. They started dyeing it yellow, and then, of course, now it's that awful orange, for whatever reason, but, the yellow...
For reasons unclear.
For reasons unclear to us. Cheese is now orange, but, yeah, they started adding a little bit of food coloring to make it seem like your cheese was richer, fattier, as if it was from, you know, these really healthy grass-fed cows that were producing fatty milk. Mm. When in fact, that's not, by the way, where the orange cheese comes from, so don't believe it. But yeah. So yeah, the yellow butter. And it's sort of unusual to see at first, because sometimes it's very yellow. Very yellow. It's beautiful. Once you don't expect your butter to be white anymore.
Well, I know living up here, you haven't had an opportunity to listen to this show yet.
No, I haven't.
We will try to remedy that in the future. Sometimes I end the show with a segment called Gratitude Journal. I'm wondering, What are you thankful for lately?
Lately, I am thankful for, I guess, this piece of land that I've been so lucky to be able to live on. It's so beautiful here, and the land is somewhat unspoiled. Not many people get to live in a place so removed and so wild. I feel very thankful for that. I think it forces me to sort of slow down, take everything in. And I'm also thankful for my partner, because as winter's approaching, I think we're realizing how heavily we rely on each other. Probably more so than a lot of couples, because our physical well-being is sort of in the other's hands up here. The elements are so severe that if, you know, your partner's not watching out for you and you're not both giving your 100%, you know, you could really physically suffer from that and quickly. So I think I have a lot to be thankful for right now. And I'm thankful you're here visiting me in Vermont.
It's been such a fun, too short. It's been too short, but it's been a really fun time visiting with you guys. It could be a while till we see each other again.
It could be.
But maybe next time we could get Jess involved in the interview. He is a little under the weather with a cold today.
He is a little under the weather.
But maybe we can get him to join in.
That would be fabulous. If you can take him out of his hermit shell. It's quite an accomplishment when that happens, but it's a beautiful thing.
Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you, Sarah.
Our quote this week is in honor of one of my sister's wildebeests, Thoreau. This quote is from Henry David Thoreau. "Nothing makes the earth seem so spacious as to have friends at a distance. They make longitudes and latitudes." Thank you for listening. The music in today's episode is So Wheat, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire, just like Linda Curtis, but out on a wire. It's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Nature's herb will get you high till your face is smile. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a